Bill Pullman, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Monday, December 18th. My name is Adam Shartoff. You're listening to FilmWax Radio, episode number 451. Today we have two segments coming up. One is regarding a new documentary called The Family I Had. We have the filmmakers Carly Rubin and Katie Green, as well as one of the subjects of the film. Her name is Charity Lee, and it's a very intense story, and we'll get to that in a second. After that, we have the director of a new Western. It's currently out, actually, in New York already, but it is also, I think, opening in Los Angeles this coming Friday, which is, I believe, the 22nd of December. So, and then even broader. And that one is called The Ballad of Lefty Brown. And we have the director, Jared Moshe, as well as the actor, Bill Pullman, which is exciting. I was up last night. I couldn't get to bed, so I put on a film that had just sort of been arbitrarily, you know, on this list. Not arbitrary that it was on the list, but I just chose it arbitrarily, called May in the Summer. I had no idea why it was on my list, other than I probably read something really good about it or something intrigued me about it, and so I put it on my list of films to check out when I can, and I finally just found it and put it on, and then all of a sudden there's like one American actor, and it's Bill Pullman again, which is kind of funny, since the film takes place in Jordan, and it's filled with mostly either Mediterranean actors or Mediterranean American actors. It was just kind of funny, but Bill Pullman plays an American who works there and lives there. But in this film, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, Bill Pullman is the lead actor in this film, and it's terrific. And we're going to talk to Bill and Jared Moshe, again, the director, in just a little while. But first up here, again, the documentary is called The Family I Had. It's going to have its broadcast premiere on December the 21st on Investigation Discovery. Check your local listings. The film had its world premiere at Tribeca Film Festival this past spring. It screened at the Hamptons International Film Festival, New Orleans Film Festival, Camden International, Raindance Film Festival, and the Melbourne International Film Festival. It's an amazing story. Charity, who's going to be on this segment coming up now, walks a fine line between love and fear of her son Paris. It's been 10 years since Paris killed his sister, Charity's daughter, and she is left questioning his chance at redemption and her ability to forgive. We peel back the layers to reveal a family history previously marked by intra-family violence as she embraces motherhood for a third time with a new baby boy. Multiple accounts allow for conflicting points of view, leaving the audience questioning where the ultimate truth and accountability lies. All right, so again, it's called The Family I Had. We have the team coming up right now. Again, we have filmmakers Carly Rubin and Katie Green with the subject of the documentary, Charity Lee, and they're all appearing here on episode 451 of FilmWax Radio right now.
911, go ahead.
I accidentally killed somebody.
You think you killed somebody?
No, I know I did. My sister. I feel so messed up.
The day that Ella was born, Paris fell in love. Years later, he destroyed my life. I'm horrified about what he did to Ella, but I never stopped loving Paris. Paris knows somewhere inside of him, he is dark. And it's so obvious that he needs help. He said, you used to say that you would never be able to kill anybody unless they hurt one of your kids. I bet you didn't think it was going to turn out like this.
I'm really delighted to be with you guys. I'm sitting with the directors of a new documentary called The Family I Had, Carly Rubin and Katie Green. And also, I would say, the primary subject of the documentary, Charity Lee, and the film will be broadcasting on Investigation Discovery on December 21st. And everybody's got to see this documentary. It is really a powerful story, to say the least. And so we can talk about it. And the film premiered at Tribeca Film Festival this year, right? Obviously, this past April or what have you. I don't know how I missed it. My mistake. But I got to catch up with it.
A lot of great films there this year.
Talking to the mic, though.
A lot of great films there this year. That's probably
why. Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's also there's so many that you kind of like, or you kind of have to just fly by the seat of your pants a little bit, you know. But I eventually catch up because, of course, the films come out via broadcast or theatrical. Did you do any theatricals, or is that something that's happening?
No, we're not doing theatricals. Mm-hmm. We did a short sort of festival circuit.
Sure, and good ones, I might add. Very top of the line.
Yeah, we had some great festivals. Great festivals and really nice audiences. Mm-hmm. And no, now we're going to go straight to broadcast.
Can I ask what went into that decision, if you can discuss it? Like, what went into that decision? Is it just, as opposed to doing theatricals, which... Is there an answer? Maybe.
I don't think that's right.
Much of a decision. Yeah.
It was just like something you knew you were going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think they weren't. We didn't
hold it. Just keep talking.
This was not going to be a film that they felt was suitable for theatrical.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess having a network that was interested just gave us the opportunity to go straight to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hi, Charity.
Hi.
it's covering some very dark material. There's something about the way you shot it, though, and the way you produced it. Which actually really doesn't feel that way. It may be because over the course of the film, there's something that opens up and seems to kind of elevate the subject matter about in terms of maybe hope and healing, that part of it, the story. Charity, what do you think? And now that, of course, you've been part of the whole process, and I'm sure you've seen the film a few times. How was it from your perspective?
From my perspective, it was, I just lived my life and they followed me around. I mean, it was no, you know, when they first contacted me, it was to make a completely different film. And so somewhere in the process, we shifted gears and I've always just been okay with it. I don't know why, because I didn't know Katie and Carly when they contacted me, but I was just like, sure, you can come follow me around. And I felt comfortable, so it was fine.
Were you approached by any other filmmakers to tell part of your story or the whole, the, you know, because there's a various parts of the story that are all kind of converge.
Right.
But were you ever approached before?
No, not by anybody else.
Okay. So tell me... co-directors. Tell me about that. What was the initial project about, supposed to be about?
Right.
And so, how did it evolve?
So we were following... we were looking...
I want to jump in.
We were initially looking at juvenile life without parole sentencing, we're really going back to 2012.
Okay.
And once that shift happened in terms of that becoming unconstitutional in terms of mandatory sentences for juveniles, we thought we would broaden our, you know... spectrum and look at just extreme sentencing of youth. So we were, you know, very much looking for stories of juveniles in the system and their families and really how it affected
mm-hmm.
the families.
It's a great story too, but I can see why once you met Charity and heard her story, and it was still, you know, going on in real time. So
right, so we were following Charity in another case actually for a few years, and you know, the more we spent time with her and her family and got to know her and learn more about her story, we realized that it was very difficult to kind of pigeonhole this story within this wider, you know, kind of macro look at the system.
Right.
So that's when we kind of pivoted, but that wasn't without its endless conversations and going back and forth about, was this the right decision and would the family be open to it, and was that the film we wanted to make?
Yeah.
So it was a difficult shift, but...
Sure, I'm sure it was. Can I ask you, again, talk about what you can, and if there's certain things, I don't know, I'm not privy to all the background of it, but if you had, did you have Investigation Discovery, for instance, or Motto on board for the initial theme, which was juvenile?
No, it was actually only once we pivoted, and decided we were going to pursue both stories, but as separate films.
Yes, okay.
And at that time, I think the family I had, which wasn't called the family I had at that time, it was just an untitled.
Yeah.
We then were involved in TFI Network, which is an event that Tribeca hold, where they pair filmmakers with it's the industry. Right. And that's where we met Motto. And that was really our first time really kind of going out and pitching and saying, I think, you know, this is the film we're going to make. And this is separate to what we were doing before, but this is how we see it playing out. And that's where we met Motto and Dogwoof and both.
Yeah. Oh, Dogwoof as well. Right.
Help us complete it. Yep.
Dogwoof funded Motto EP'd.
Yes.
Okay.
It was the Dogwoof, the T-Dog Fund. It's a new fund, the new documentary fund.
Oh, what is it called?
I think it's called the T-Dog Fund.
Okay. That sounds right.
Yeah,
I think
keeping it with a dog theme,
yeah,
canine
yeah.
theme.
There's a lot of there are quite a few. We love dogs here on the podcast. Certainly, nothing wrong with that. Well, you know, I'm almost. It's you know, here's the thing. I got very lucky because I really knew very little about the film. As I said, I didn't catch up with it at the Tribeca Film Festival, and I so I did, I just got sent the documentary link actually, and I went into it completely not knowing a thing about it. I like that sometimes. I don't want to read too much because I want to be surprised. So when it comes time to normally what I would be doing is talking about the your story, Charity, and I would be laying out the synopsis, and I just don't know. It's like even though you in the press notes and you know you have to kind of talk about the film, it's like an onion, which throughout the film you know keeps getting peeled. And you learn more and more about your family and your story, Charity. But I feel like I don't even want to start peeling it, you know, because I don't want to give away anything because this story is just so incredible. You're remarkable, and your life is very remarkable. And so, but I feel like we have to talk about some of that, you know, in order to get people to go see the film, you know. So I'm going to leave a little bit of that up to you guys to you know, so we don't reveal too much. But in the end of the day, it does come down to a very highly, intensely personal story, which is something everybody has to be very sensitive around. So what, tell me, Charity, when you experienced a child, one of your children was killed by your other child, which is the root of the story. So when you have filmmakers coming in and then all of a sudden the film becomes about you and you already said you were okay with it, but did they come to you and they say, we want to change the whole thing and make it about your story? What was that conversation like for you?
Well, they just called me one day and they were like, there's been a little change. We just want to run it by you. I think was what happened, basically. And they were like, we want to focus just on this part of the other movie. And again, I just said, okay. I mean, I've always agreed to cooperate because I believe the only way to get rid of the darkness is to bring it into the light. And so I mean, I tell my own story and they need to tell the story and other people need to tell the story because it needs to be brought out into the light. What happened is extreme, but there is a lot of family violence in the world. And so in order to help people get through that, I thought it was important to just open up and give them access. One reason it was easy for me is because I think that a lot of people who are the victims of violent crime or they have a violent criminal in their family, they feel a lot of shame. And I wanted to show people that there's no shame. You know, this is human behavior, whether we like it or not. It's not the healthiest of human behaviors, but good things can still come. And so pretty much whatever the girls proposed, I was just like, okay. And they ran with it. I mean, I've pretty much just said yes to them all the time and giving them access to whatever they want access to, and it makes life really easy. I mean, you just keep saying yes, so.
And you're still saying thankfully you're joining us today. I appreciate it because it's your story and it should never, the focus of the conversation couldn't get far from that, you know. I'm a parent myself, so I can understand. So did you guys have a, she basically described the conversation pretty accurately, I guess, right? Were you worried about what all that would entail, shifting the story to hers? And
sure. I mean, you know, I think we were worried on several levels. For one, we had done a Kickstarter campaign, and we were pitching one film.
How much were you raising for that? 40. Okay, 40. It's modest for
a... Charity knows. Talk to our financial, our financial expert over here. It wasn't a lot of money, and we really like...
Right, but still.
It's not our strong suit, fundraising, but that's a whole other conversation. But yeah, so we felt a slight concern to our backers.
You felt obligated to your backers.
Right, but I think we were incredibly honest with them up front and said, mm-hmm. this is what's going on. We're shifting. We're not, you know, we're still making this other film, but this is what's going on and here's why. Right. So that was one concern. And the other concern was, you know, when you approach somebody to make a film about one thing and then you shift in the process, which happens in documentaries sometimes, you know, you don't want to feel like you're misleading, or like it was as much of a surprise to us as it was probably to Charity. Mm-hmm. So there was that concern as well.
Yeah. So Charity, your son, his name is Paris. He's currently serving 40 years? 40 year sentence. Okay, pull the number, because that's just such an extreme sentence. It's mind-boggling. Was he coming up for parole at a certain point?
Not until 2027.
Okay.
He has to serve half of his sentence. He's a capital murderer in Texas, and the law says he has to serve 50% of his sentence. He doesn't get good time credit. He doesn't get credit for anything.
That's just the mandatory part of the arrangement, I understand. Yeah. And... How do you work with the system? I of course don't have any knowledge of it, so I just don't. In terms of interviewing him, and how many times did you guys go to and sit with Paris over time?
So every state is different. I mean, during the process of actually, you know, the original film we were making, we actually had some experience of learning which states you can get inside to film in, and Texas allows you access to any inmate. For 1 hour every 3 months, I think you can apply for an interview. Wow. And you have a very sort of set, I mean, you can see in the film, through the everything. It's not the most aesthetically pleasing interview setup, but that's the situation. And we got to film Paris, I think we went 3 times over the course of 3 years. I think we went once a year.
Okay.
Mm. And we had about an hour to an hour and a half each time with him.
I think the first time they forgot about us, the guards forgot about us. So we did get, it was almost about 2 hours that we had together. But every other time, you know, there's guards
rigid.
There.
They were rigid.
I think the guard was like in and out. Hovering. But I think the media handler, like these prisons have media handlers, which is just weird in itself. But had come in and be like, oh, you're still here, like filming. So, but yeah. Oh.
Paris had just arrived that morning as well. He'd just been transferred from a juvenile.
He had been transferred.
From his other prison. So he had, I mean, I have to say, like, must have been such a strange experience for Paris to just arrive that morning at this new prison. And then within like a couple of hours, he had was there having this interview with us. And
That's when he was.
But he was incredibly focused and professional in this sort of.
But wasn't that the time that we thought they were moving him to make it more difficult?
We had put in the request to film with him, and then I think we hadn't heard, and we were filming with you, and I think we got word when we were with you
that he had been transferred,
and
that birthday.
Exactly, and we were able to get access because
he was transferred on his birthday, on his birthday too, and to the more violent. Prison, right? Where you were really Charity. You were reading up on, which is also a new thing to learn, that you can actually read like the Yelp version of the prisons and find
Yelp.
Out.
It is Yelp.
That was Yelp.
There are people that I mean, you can find them on Yelp and Google reviews, and people start, you know, Facebook pages, and
that's incredible. I mean, I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but what a incredible, well, it's a double-edged sword in a way, because, you know, maybe a generation ago, Charity, you know, parents couldn't, or friends or loved ones couldn't go and couldn't find out any information other than maybe letters you got. And, of course, you know, those are edited. So, but now you can actually go and find out all this information. But it could also be really stressful, too, because you're finding out, you know, that maybe he's involved. He's now been moved to a place where he's more vulnerable to safety, you know, and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, in that scene in particular, I remember, you know, that's why it was so important to include that scene for us, because you really saw the pain on Charity's face when she was reading these reviews.
Right, because the first part was relief, because he was actually transferred to a facility that was much closer to her home, right? And she was had a newborn, essentially, well, a very young child.
Yeah.
And then finding out that it's a more dangerous spot. That
The gladiator unit.
Those are words you don't want to read, but he's been... I actually just ask us if it's been a worse experience for him in that place.
He's okay. He adapts very well. Mm. He's very chameleon-like.
I guess that's a good skill set to have if you're...
In a prison. Yes, in a prison. He does all right. If he's had any problems, he hasn't told me.
So I'm going to just paint a little bit more, or you guys can, about the story, just as up to a degree anyway. Like I said, I'm a little hesitant to divulge very much of the onion, but it's... So Paris killed his younger sister, and for more details, it's really important to see the film. But Paris was in prison for the crime, and then your mother's story unfolds as well. We don't have to necessarily go into that, but there's a lot going on with your family history. It's a big onion, is right. It's so complicated, and it's easy to kind of want to say things like, as I did as I was watching it, but it seems almost superficial afterwards, but that, like, how violence can run through a family. But on some level, it can. It can run through a family because you're not dealing with it indirectly. You're, as you say, shame makes people not deal with those things. I think you broke that cycle, though, because of your... going transparent, you know. But it can also be, I think, a cliche to say, you know, well, it must have been inherited, this, because your mother's experiences that you lived through as a young child, and then this sort of went down to your own child. You know, it's easy to simplify and paint this kind of, you know, picture, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the problem, which is about hiding and shame, and the shame around violence within a family, right? I'm just putting it out there. Was that that wasn't really a question, was it? It was more of a comment, but it's what I took away from the film. Is there, in other words, let me rephrase it. The film deals with the shame, as you put it, Charity, violence inside of a family. So one could sort of say this cliche about how, you know, maybe violence is inherited, but it's more that it's just not dealt with directly, so it keeps coming up.
I think it's both. And I think that, I mean, you know, we forget as people that we're not, I mean, we're a body, we're a physical body, and we're also a mind, right? And so violence can be passed down through the mind, but violence can also be passed down through the genes. And we know now that if you experience a traumatic event, it will alter your physiology. Or if you suffer a trauma, you know, physically, it can alter your cognitions and your affect. And so I think that it's violence is passed down in ways that we don't even understand yet. But in order to gain any understanding of it, we have to be transparent about it. Because it's a very complex and complicated interaction between, you know, family psychological history, family genetics, and we're just not really sure. I mean, researchers and scientists aren't sure exactly what that interplay is. So I think it would be hard for any one person, and I would not really have much use for their opinion if they came in and said, oh, it was this, it was all your mother, or oh, it was all you when you did that thing, or oh, it was, no, it was this. I'd be like, no, we don't, I don't even know 10 years after it happened exactly why it happened, but we've learned more, and the way that we learn more is to have people like me that will allow themselves, I guess, for lack of a better word, to be studied, picked apart. I love research.
Apparently so.
So, you know, and my family is a very interesting topic to research.
Yeah, there's a lot of highly intelligent people in this family, which might only make matters actually more difficult in terms of researching.
Makes it a bit more complicated.
Yeah, but you it should also be mentioned that you yourself have counseled family members of violence, right?
Yes.
As a counselor and a...
Not as an official counselor, just as somebody who's gone through it. I mean, I would never claim to have a license or anything like that. I'm all self-educated through experience and learning. But I've, you know, all I've done is I've attempted to help people get through their own hard time.
Yeah. And I think that's a really crucial role in helping somebody else is that they're going to feel a lot more safe talking to somebody who's gone through it and who's actually surviving it. So it's an incredible amount of work to do. The film, again, is called The Family I Had. What did you make of the film, Charity? And did Paris get to see? I know that he's in prison and probably that's not going
to
be...
No access to that.
Yeah, so he has no idea. Necessarily, although you must have, I guess, described it.
Oh, he knows about the...
Oh, no, obviously. No, I mean about the actual end product.
No. He won't get to see that until he's released from prison.
What did you make of the film when you finally... Well, describe that situation when you guys must have had butterflies in terms of showing it to Charity and maybe your mom got to see it, of course, and that had to be a little bit nerve-wracking for you to show it finally.
Of course, but... Yeah. Incredibly important for us, and we got to a point where we said we had to come and show Charity. We went to Charity's home, and sat down with her and wanted to make sure that both her and Kyla had the opportunity to watch it before it was going to be shown publicly, and that was obviously a responsibility we felt, and we were very nervous. I mean, Charity has been incredibly gracious.
Right.
With her time and her story over the years. So it was important to us that she felt we had done it justice.
Sure, and she endorses the film. And did you have anything to add, Carla?
No, I mean, I think in any film process, it's the most nerve-wracking part is to show your subjects. I mean, of course, you want people to like your film and want to see your film and all of that, but... The front lines is always the subjects, and I can remember with our first film, being incredibly just ill over the idea of having to show them, but knowing how important it was. So this was no different. This was, slightly more emotionally, I think, heightened because of the subject matter and, knowing that we were dredging up all these old traumas, and we felt a lot of guilt and incredible responsibility.
Sure, of course.
So.
Yeah. Were you there, Tribeca, and... couple of other festivals.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just Tribeca.
Okay. What was your experience seeing the film finally for the first time?
It was harder than I thought it would be, but not because the telling the story is not hard for me. But they had asked for, and I gave them a lot of the old movies from the home movies. And one of the ways that I'm able to cope with what happened is I think about the past a lot, and I can write about the past, but to visually see my past is very difficult. And so the first time I saw the film and I saw Ella and her brother together again, that was hard. But as far as the story or having it out there, that's, to me, it's hard for very personal reasons. Because those are my babies, and I miss them still. And so just to see them. And, it was interesting to kind of see it from somebody else's perspective. But the hard thing for me is just seeing the kids. That's it.
Well, thank you for being so honest and open still. The name of the film, again, is The Family I Had. It's co-directed by Carly Rubin and Katie Green. And we'll be on Investigation Discovery again on December 21st, right? So check your local listings, and we'll put details up on our show notes and all that about it. But thank you.
Thank you
all so much for doing this interview. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nice meeting
you.
Okay, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, currently playing in Manhattan. Got some good reviews, by the way. And if you're a fan of the Western, you know, going back to, from all the way back to, of course, Howard Hawks and John Ford, right through Sam Peckinpah, perhaps, and the more modern take on the Western genre, you know, Robert Altman, et cetera. This is your film, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, starring Bill Pullman. In supporting roles, Peter Fonda, Kathy Baker. Pretty impressive cast. Peter Fonda connecting back to, of course, John Ford, and that his dad, Henry Fonda, was in several John Ford Westerns in his day, right? So there's a direct connection. Let's see, the synopsis for The Ballad of Lefty Brown. When cowboy Lefty Brown, played by our guest Bill Pullman, witnesses the murder of his longtime partner, the newly elected Senator Edward Johnson, Fonda, he strikes out to find the killers and avenge his friend's gruesome death. Tracking the outlaws across the vast and desolate Montana plains, Lefty recruits a young gunslinger, Jeremiah, played by actor Diego Joseph, and an old friend, a hard-drinking U.S. Marshal, played by the wonderful Tommy Flanagan, to help deliver the men to justice. I should mention that I believe this was shot on film. I neglected to ask about that in this. I meant to. It was in my notes, but I neglected to ask there. But I saw the Kodak provided the film for this movie, so I'm just... But I assume it was shot on film. It certainly looks like it. It's a beautiful, picturesque film. It's heartening that you could still shoot a movie like this in these United States. Well, without any further hesitation, here it is. A conversation about the movie, The Ballad of Lefty Brown, with filmmaker Jared Moshe and actor Bill Pullman. And we'll be back afterward for the outro.
Marshal, 40 years we rode together, and I never got anything right.
Maybe somebody else ought to be in charge.
Now don't you go starting on me, too.
I ain't starting nothing.
I reckon you're going to stand tall, or I ain't.
Somebody killed Edward.
You were supposed to watch his back.
Ed Blondville, he's going to pay for this.
Eddie was my friend.
Governor, I'm so glad you came.
Nowhere else I'd be. We've lost one friend, and I don't plan on losing another. Chase down Eddie's killer and bring him back.
So yeah, so I'm friendly with the Smith brothers. In fact, I spoke with Alec, and he was texting me just a few minutes ago. He said, make sure to ask Bill about the orchard it's the orchard's the one that's in New York, makes sense, and the ranch is in Montana, right?
Right.
Yeah. A little closer.
Oh, yes.
You can hold it too if you want to.
Okay.
And so anyway, so you're obviously a man who's of the land. So these parts are natural, whether it's of course Jared's film, Ballad of Lefty Brown, which is why we're here, or the Smith brothers' recent film. Did you get a chance to see that, Jared?
I got to see it at South by Southwest. It was incredible. I mean, Montana has such a wonderful landscape, yes. And they do such a fantastic job of capturing that.
Yeah,
crafting a story that is so much about that world.
Mm-hmm. You seem like such a nice young man. He's wearing a very festive, like kind of a winter sweater. I don't know how to like a, it's kind of like arts and crafty kind of sweater.
Yeah,
and
it's verging on holiday sweater.
You make these big old Westerns. It's
I'm the Jew from New York who likes making Western movies.
Well, that's pretty awesome.
Who was introduced to Westerns by my father, who's Greek, or born and raised in Greece.
Okay. But you grew up in New York?
I grew up in New York, yeah.
Okay, very good. By the way, I'm also friendly because the podcast just keeps leading me back to David Call, the actor.
Oh, David's great.
Yeah,
he's such a good guy.
Yeah. He worked with the Dead Man's Burden.
Dead Man's Burden.
So, well, I'm glad to be here and to talk about this film. I loved it. I'm a big fan of the old Westerns as well. So this is right in line, you know, with that whole mythology of the American West. And so I'm guessing you grew up with that at home.
I grew up watching Westerns. I think for my dad at first, I think, you know, for him when he's a kid, America just exported so many Westerns to Europe. It's what he grew up watching. But for me, I'm just, I love that place where like mythology and history meets, and the Western is that.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's so amazing. And there's something just so cinematic and incredible to, you know, just watch a guy ride tall in the saddle, or the cowboy, or the images, you know,
sure.
The West, the American Indian. It's just so impressive.
I agree. And it's interesting. I guess if you get into to the whole genre deep enough, you realize that at some point there's a bit of a split off where, you know, the old John Ford, Howard Hawks started to get more and more, I don't know if the word is sophisticated, but they started taking the kind of psychological, emotional aspects of the characters a bit more, you know. So, and this what I like about Lefty Brown is it takes some of the old tropes, of course, like the sidekick, you know, usually played by Gabby Hayes or Walter Brennan, as, you know, we know. But you, in here, this case, you've made it a fully fleshed out character with all sorts of dimensions, you know. So it's a very interesting way in.
You know. Yeah, I think that I've always been really interested in that character. You know, because that character like exists in every Western. There's always a sidekick, and often it's comedic, and often it's laughed at.
Right, it's usually the comic relief,
yeah,
or comic foil, or what have you.
You know, we just, you know, we hosted this Western marathon in Austin a couple of weeks ago, and one of the movies we watched was Red River, and like I had actually forgotten the whole like Walter Brennan loses his teeth while playing poker, and throughout the entire movie he's like arguing with a guy with this guy he lost his teeth over, like, and he's like doesn't have his teeth. It's like it's so comedic,
right.
And yet, you know, in that movie, when John Wayne has three guys who are about to kill him, who saves him? It's Walter Brennan, who throws him his rifle.
Now you know, it's not so surprising. I confuse Walter Brennan and Gabby Hayes often, and now I have Bill Pullman to confuse in there as well. They are all so similar. You are you're taking something from those characters a little bit. There's something in your speech and your body language. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's always interesting to suddenly see the movie and realize what's been going on. And I think Jared always had in mind that there's some evolution, and I think you kind of there's an evolution even in the pitch of his voice, according to the take sheet. Because I've watched the movie a few times, I realize, oh, the clever director was starting me out, and I'd go up high sometimes early on. And I remember thinking, you know, but I don't really like thinking about the arc of a character myself when I'm doing a movie, because I think it's like a critical kind of exterior observation about a character, and people aren't always, and there is a kind of amazing thing how little people change, you know, and so I but in that journey of in the film, you can feel that Lefty's whole pitch even changes, and by the somewhere in the after the first third of it, it's really no that high register never happens again. So,
It's so people listening. I mean, I like how you don't even you just allude to him as a sidekick. It's a term we don't even really hear too much. Today in today's films, like somebody's, you know, like the intentionally designed to be the sidekick, but
I feel like at this point it's like when sidekick, it's like Robin to Batman.
Yeah.
You know, it's superheroes have just sort of taken over that term.
Yeah, the sidekick. Yeah, well, without getting too much, but I wanted to kind of describe the synopsis just a little enough to give people so they can follow. Peter Fonda, and I see him almost tapping into that very. The kind of slow cadence of a John Wayne or something like that, just to give people a brushstroke idea. But he's early on, he's murdered, and so Bill, your character then goes after the killers. That becomes your which again is part of that mythology of avenging, you know, your friend's death, your murder.
I think also for Lefty, though, it's a matter of he doesn't really have anything else to do. I mean, well, it's like he knows this is what he's supposed to do. He doesn't really feel at home.
Code, right?
Yeah, it's like he's supposed to do it, but he also sort of doesn't quite – his home has suddenly become very inhospitable. Mm-hmm. You know, and he knows it's the right thing, but I think if someone else was going to do it, he'd be happy for them to do it.
Well, besides the great Bill Pullman and the cast, you also have Peter Fonda and Kathy Baker. It's pretty, I mean, how does that, you probably kind of, I'm guessing, grew up with those.
Oh, yeah, Kathy. I grew up watching Kathy Baker on Picket Fences.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, me too. No. But, no, but it's incredible. I mean, I grew up with her in, even earlier when she was, a young movie actor who you'd see quite often in these great 70s films and whatnot.
She's such a talented actor. And I can't, it was her first Western. Like, I mean, she just had, she should be in a Western. So I was really glad to work with her on it.
Right. And
she, you know, I think she did an incredible job with that performance.
Yeah. And even though she's a supporting character, she really has this, you've given her a full, again, very, I think, a real life, you know, and she's a strong woman. She's has her own set of goals. You know, she's inherited, she actually rather has not inherited the ranch from her husband because of, you know, the way the laws were at the time. But is very, very, you know.
But she's going
to
run that ranch.
Motivated to run it and get it into her hands, as she should, right? So it's really great that all the characters are so well fleshed out. Bill, you're like in every moment of the film, practically. You're like in almost every single scene. Was it very, how long was the shoot, and what was that experience?
It wasn't enough.
No.
I wanted to be more than in every scene. I wanted to be in the credits.
I figured you want to read the credits, like instead of enrolling them.
First up, Bill Pullman. Second up, Kathy Baker. It was very odd that the first day of shooting was the one day I didn't work. So I came to the set, you know, because I wanted to just kind of break that barrier. You know, you're always a certain amount of energy you carry. When you're starting a movie, I find, and the first day, it's good to kind of make your way there beforehand. And so I got to watch everybody and from afar. But then the rest of the days, we were running and gunning for every day.
What was the shooting schedule? What was it like?
Should we hold because of these sirens?
You know what? If I did that for every one of my episodes here in Manhattan, I would be like...
Oh, isn't that nice? You got good mics.
It's the soundtrack of my show is sirens, emergency vehicles nonstop. It's okay. Kind of, I think it gives a little bit of charm to it, like people that are listening from, like, all of a sudden it gives them a perspective of the location and
stuff. But they don't have to worry. This is not a fire in this building. Because this is radio. Right. People can't.
There is a fire, all right. It's right in this room.
Yeah.
You guys are on fire. Well, where was I? Before the... Oh, no, yeah.
Siri with the win right there.
Is that Siri? Tell her to mind her own business. Unless she has a good question.
I don't know. She always pops up. And my wife can never get Siri to work, except when, like, she doesn't want Siri to work.
Mm-hmm.
She'll, like, say something to me, and suddenly Siri will pop up. It's... I don't know. We shot it in 20 days.
Okay.
So Bill worked 19 of them.
Yeah.
And he hung out on one.
Right, as we said. But it's for those who are listening, and I know there are many, you actually don't live too far from where you shot, right? Right, Bill? You're pretty close by, so it wasn't too big a trip, right?
Well, that was all coincidence.
Was it?
It originally was going to be shot in New Mexico and then maybe Calgary and then Montana, but Montana's a big state.
Hear.
Yeah, the distance from the southeast corner to the northwest corner is the distance from Washington, D.C. to Chicago.
That's
a big one. So when Jared got on the phone and said, we love this, found a ranch, it's a town beginning with W. And
you were like?
I go through the Rolodex, you know, because Wolf Point, that's 5 hours away. Well, that's still better than, you know, New Mexico. But it ended up being on a ranch that the first 2 weeks were 20 minutes from the house.
That's what I read,
It was unusual. And all the people that were in the crowd scenes I knew because they were all people that I forced Jared to look at and consider. And he was willing to do that. And it was such an important thing that we're going to get to go back to Montana in January and do a road show and take it to the little small old movie houses in
about
six cities. Yeah. And some are restored and fixed up. And
beautiful.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. It's good to hear that, you know. Yeah. Speaking of which, the crowd scenes and the smaller, some of the extras, rather, were your own family members, right, Bill?
Yeah, yeah.
Your, like, niece played a whore.
And, I understand. My nephew's wife, she got a rump. That and then the son of a tractor mechanic and the taxidermist was in it. And my one son played the banjo in the saloon. And,
oh, yes, right.
Wife and daughter were in the hanging scene. And son Lewis was the one who put the noose around my neck. He had speaking part. Billy Kitchen, just he had great enthusiasm for that. So
I got to ask you, since you brought it up, what is that experience like? I mean, having a noose, the feel of a noose around your neck.
Yeah.
You can kind of relate all of a sudden to this historically to all these people that have been...
Well, you think about what...
Handed those punishments.
What it is to, you know, have a crowd pulling you.
Yeah.
And you feel that this, you know, there's subduing you and rendering you inactive and then putting a noose around your neck. It's a pretty scary thing. And we did it as the way Jared designed it. I'm getting dragged back to a log hut where they're going to pull off, and just string me up right
back.
They
seem real ready. They were ready to go with that scene. It's like they were... Sorry?
Yeah.
Oh, sure, soon. Yeah. Anyway.
There's going to be a deleted scene that on the DVD where you get to see them beat him up. And it's pretty brutal.
Yeah? Was that... Were you supposed to be beaten up?
It was a different scene.
Okay.
Different scene.
Yeah, he didn't look...
No. It was a different scene that was much earlier in the movie.
Okay.
That got cut out. But I really liked the scene, and I liked the fighting, and I liked that Bill's son got to punch him. He was only supposed to punch him once in the stomach.
He
punched him twice.
Oh, yeah. That's what you get for being a good actor.
Yeah, and it was a cool scene. I love the way it was shot, but it just, you know, it was one of those things where, like, oh, you cut it out, and it went smoother. So it'll be on the DVD.
Oh, well, we're plugging the DVD. That's good. That's good. We're
plugging everything.
No problem with that, by the way. And when the time comes, I'll be sure to repost the show. And when you were doing those crowds, interesting because, you know, at one point there was in various places where they would hang people or there was the guillotine as well. There was a bloodthirst in the audience, you know, like in the crowd. But I kind of was looking for that in your crowd. Even it was a very big crowd, but there was a scene where I was watching where there was a hanging in the film, and I was kind of looking to see what was the tone at that time, because of course things did change where, you know, where people are still relatively immune to the violence of that, because violence was such a central thing in everyone's lives, you know. Mm-hmm. But that still, it seemed like they understood the weight, the burden of that, of being complicit by watching it. And it seemed like some of the people really did have a hard time, even though they were kids in there.
I think it was a complex thing by that point.
Complex.
But, you know, it's, you know, 1889, the frontier is starting to close off. It's more civilized than it's ever been before there. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people, there was still like this, the, you know, entertaining value of it, but, you know, you bring your family and such forth. But for a lot of other people, you know, this was, you know, this shouldn't be happening. We're a civilized society.
Yeah.
You know, we are now a state.
Right.
And we shouldn't be hanging people.
That's right. Well, the name of the film is called The Ballad of Lefty Brown. And it's going to be here in New York in theaters a week from...
No, tonight.
Tonight?
Opens tonight.
I better work fast.
Opens tonight.
It's currently screening in New York and where...
The Village East and in L.A.
In L.A.
And it's going to roll out at the Lemley NoHo in L.A. And it's going to be rolling out in more theaters in January.
Okay, great. Well, thank you both, guys. Beautiful, lovely. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. It was really... I just was walking around and I was doing a series before. So catch that movie. Bill Pullman, by the way, how wonderful to bring him on finally, right? I mean, this guy, Bill Pullman has such an amazing career. He's done so many great roles and, you know, but anybody who was in Lost Highway, come on. Of course I'm going to have him on my show. he's certainly working a lot these days. Pullman, he's in demand. So I appreciate that we were able to get him on the podcast. Okay, folks, please do subscribe on iTunes. Please do leave a star rating and a review on iTunes, and follow us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. We're there. Just search FilmWax Radio on any of those social network platforms, and you'll find it quite easily. We're also on YouTube. You can listen to the show on YouTube as well as see other videos. That's one of the things that hopefully will expand after the Kickstarter. We'll be having more video content, I'm hoping, from interviews. But do subscribe and introduce what we're doing to any friends of yours who may be film fans. All right? It'll be a great help to me and the show, and I appreciate it very much. And so we'll sign off here. Until next time, we'll be back in a little while with just another episode of the podcast, okay? In the meantime, take care of yourself and the ones you love. All right. Bye-bye.